die when they evacuated? Locking them in here like animals in a slaughter pen? What kind of people could do this? Fury erupted within Desmond, and the thought that he had once been part of this project repulsed him. He activated his comm. I found bodies. They were testing something here. Copy, William said. I've located the target. He's found the shipping manifest. Desmond breathed a sigh of relief. Level 3, front left corner, William said. Avery and Desmond acknowledged and said they were inbound to his location. William ducked in and out of the offices, searching quickly. In an office on the corner, with a couch and a bar-height-long table, he found what he was looking for. The same picture he had seen in the home. His three children, holding hands on a street in London. It had been taken around 1982, William thought. This was the right office. He moved to the filing cabinet, yanked it open, and began reading the folder names. He paused at one that read, Viral Candidates. He pulled it out, scanned it. They had evaluated several pathogens for modification. He froze when he saw the notes in the margins. Yes, he was on the right track. The rest of the drawer was filled with more research, documents of their trials. The drawer below that one had folders on distribution methods. They had tried air fresheners, hand soap, even cologne. All had proved either too expensive or ineffective. The next drawer had folders marked with locations. Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. Dakar, Senegal. Harare, Zimbabwe. Lusaka, Zambia. Bamako, Mali. Conakry, Guinea. This is it, William thought. He opened the first folder, read quickly. It was a study of the location's population, economy, transportation, and infrastructure. The page heading read, Index Site Study. These were places they had considered starting the outbreak. One of the files was marked Mandera. William slammed the drawer shut, pulled open the last one. A folder marked Supply Shipments sat in the very front. He pulled it out and let it fall open. Inside were shipping manifests, hundreds of them. Medical supplies, water, food. Were those words used as code for the virus or the cure? They certainly wouldn't list virus or cure on the shipping manifest. No, this had to be it. Into his mic he said, Desmond, Avery, I've located the target. Level 3, front left corner. He studied the folder, lost in thought. Desmond's voice came over the comm. William, I'm almost to you. The explosion that ripped through the office threw William against the wall. The metal filing cabinet toppled over, trapping his leg. In the home's living room, Peyton heard the explosion. She leapt from the couch and raced into the street. The largest building in the complex was on fire. Another explosion went off, blasting brick and roof tiles from the facade like lava spewing from a volcano. She didn't hesitate. She began running toward the building, coughing as she went, her lungs already burning. Chapter 90. The blast knocked Desmond off his feet. He rolled across the white-tiled floor. Ceiling tiles rained down on him. He curled up, waiting for it to stop. When the building fell quiet again, he had caught his breath. He rose and ran toward the blast location. In the corridor, long fluorescent lights hung by wires from the ceiling. Doors stood open. Plate glass windows were shattered. Shards crunched under Desmond's boots. In the stairwell, he felt warmth from above. He ascended, driving toward the blaze. When he pushed open the door to the office wing, a wave of heat blew past him. A cubicle farm spread out before him. Offices with exterior windows lay along its perimeter. Smoke and flames filled all of it. The fire was finding plenty to consume. Papers, old wooden furniture, and most concerning, the wood studs in the walls.
William, do you copy?
William's voice was weak.
Copy, Desmond. I'm pinned. I found it. I'm going to read you the location where the supplies were sent. Sit tight. Prep for evac.
Desmond studied the inferno churning through the office, trying to find a path to the corner office. Most of the cubicles and desks were burning, and the fire was moving quickly. For a moment, he was back in Australia, at his childhood home, watching the blaze. Just like then, he gathered his courage as he prepared to wade into the flames. But this time, a hand caught his shoulder. Avery stood behind him.
"Don't, Desmond."
She grabbed his arm, pulled him, but he threw her off.
"Come with me or stay," he said, "but don't get in my way."
Without another second's hesitation, he raced into the fire. Outside the building, the snow fell faster, sticking to the gravel courtyard. Peyton's footsteps left a track of prints in ash-coated snow, a trail that led directly to the front door. The heat of the fire was excruciating, but the asphyxiation was worse. Desmond held his breath as long as he could, then inhaled and coughed. He was close to passing out when he reached the corner office. The blast had blown out the windows, and cool air rushed in, fueling the fire. Desmond inhaled for a few seconds, gathering his breath. Ahead he saw William, lying under a steel filing cabinet, flailing about, looking for any means to work his way out from under it. Desmond raced to him and gripped the steel cabinet. He was shocked when he heard steps behind him. Avery. She took hold of the filing cabinet as well, and together they pushed. The cabinet was not only heavy, it was buried under debris from the wall and ceiling. But it moved just enough for William to wriggle free. He stuffed a folder inside his body armor and tried to stand. One leg was fine, but he winced when the other touched the ground. Desmond didn't wait for discussion. He leaned forward, pressed himself against William's abdomen, and lifted the man up onto his shoulder. Desmond estimated he weighed about 170 pounds, and Desmond's body protested under the added strain. His ribs still hadn't healed, but he pressed on, putting one foot in front of the other. Avery led the way, pushing desks and debris aside as they went. Soon Desmond let out the breath he had held, sucked in hard, got a mouthful of smoke, coughed, and stumbled, but he stayed upright. If he collapsed now, Avery would have to choose which one of them to drag from the flames. He felt himself getting dizzy. His head swam, vision blurred. He was staggering. He felt Avery's hand grip his arm, pulling him forward. Spots appeared in his vision. He was only vaguely aware of walking now. Waves of nausea washed over him. The smoke was a wall of black. He thought he should have been clear by this point. The fire must have advanced since he entered the blaze. He had no hope of escape. His body was shaking, wobbling as if he were being rolled in a washing machine, bounced around. His legs gave out. He fell to the floor, William on top of him. Everything went black. Peyton stopped just short of the burning rows of cubicles. She panted, trying to catch her breath. Her chest heaved and ached, but she had to push on. She covered her mouth and drew the deepest breath she could, preparing to rush in. At that moment, she saw a figure emerging from the smoke. Avery, walking backwards, dragging someone. Peyton peered around her, saw the short, dyed black hair. Desmond. As soon as she was clear of the fire, Avery fell to the floor. Desmond's head rested in her lap. Avery's eyes rolled as she leaned back and coughed. Peyton bent over Desmond, covering her mouth as she coughed. He wasn't breathing. The fire, the smoke inhalation, had asphyxiated him. With every ounce of energy she had, Peyton dragged him from Avery's legs and ripped off his body armor. Avery lay motionless, watching with watery eyes. "My father?" Peyton asked urgently. Avery closed her eyes, could barely move her head to shake it. Peyton tried to focus. She began chest compressions, counted to 30, and started giving him rescue breaths. Panting, she said, "Hey, Avery, I need you to find an AED. The woman rolled onto her belly, pushed up with her elbows on shaking arms. Her head bobbed from side to side, like a boxer about to go down for the count. She collapsed again, rolled onto her back, and gasped for breath. She would pass out soon. A scraping sound came from the wall of smoke. Peyton looked up to find her father limping out of the fire, one arm covering his mouth. She started another round of chest compressions. William fell to his knees beside her and coughed, "Get out!" Peyton looked down at Desmond. She couldn't carry him. None of them could. But she wouldn't leave him. She had lost him once. She wouldn't again. She couldn't. Couldn't bear the thought of standing outside, watching the building burn, knowing he was in there. In that moment, she finally understood, truly understood, what he had gone through as a child. It was unimaginable. The guilt, the remorse, and to go through it so young. The flames and smoke were advancing. She placed her hands under Desmond's armpits and dragged him farther away. William crawled, collapsed beside Desmond, and panted, trying to get his breath. He unstrapped his own body armor, drew out a folder. His voice came out raspy and strained.
Avery!
The woman was 10 feet from them, closer to the fire and smoke. She held her head up.
The locations! Take it! Get out!
Avery's eyes flashed. The sight of the folder seemed to give her a burst of energy. She crawled across the floor, took the folder, drew a shallow breath, and coughed again. William put a hand on her shoulder.
Go!
Peyton pressed her lips to Desmond's mouth again and began giving him rescue breaths. From her peripheral vision, she saw William push Avery away.
Go! Before it's too late!
Avery stood on unsteady legs and staggered out of the office wing. Peyton rested on her haunches, gathering her own breath as she gave 30 more chest compressions. A tear ran down her face. Desmond was going to die, right here, in her arms. Her father's eyes met hers.
Please, Dad, find an AED. He'll die without it.
Chapter 91. William was pretty sure his ankle was sprained. Not broken, but it throbbed and spiked with pain every time he put weight on it. In the smoke-filled office wing, with Peyton leaning over Desmond, trying to save his life, he limped to a desk and found what he needed. An overturned table lamp and some clear packing tape. As quickly as he could, he disassembled the lamp and jammed the metal pole in his boot, parallel to his calf. He wanted to cry out from the pain, but he simply gritted his teeth, grabbed the tape, and wrapped his lower leg and ankle tight, ensuring it couldn't move. He put weight on it, testing it. The pain was manageable. He turned and began searching the walls for an AED, hopping along like a peg-leg pirate from an old movie. With each step Avery took away from the fire, she could breathe easier. In the stairwell, she drew out the folder and scanned its contents. Past the cubicles, William hurried along the wall, searching. A minute later, he read the Russian letters for AED, pulled the device off the wall, and returned to where Peyton was still giving Desmond mouth-to-mouth. She looked up when he approached. Her face was covered in tears. The sight was heartbreaking. She took the device from his hand, tore Desmond's shirt open, and attached the patches to his chest. She made sure she wasn't touching him, then hit the large green button on the box. It emitted a short squeal, then popped, causing Desmond to arch his back and inhale violently. His head thrashed about as he screamed, a ragged, raspy yell like that of a lifelong smoker. Peyton took his face in her hands.
Hey.
His chest heaved. His eyes were barely open. A tired smile formed on his lips. He said a single word. It sounded like, Scully. William didn't know what that meant, but Peyton seemed to like it. She laughed, and the tears flowed faster now. Tears of joy, William thought.
We need to go, William said. I can walk. Peyton. Can you help him?
She coughed, trying to clear her lungs and gather a breath. Then she helped Desmond stand, and the three of them limped out of the burning building. Outside the front doors in the gravel courtyard, two sets of footprints were visible in the ash-coated snow. Peyton's, from her arrival, and Avery's. She had left them. Chapter 92. Connor sat at the conference table, listening to updates. France and Greece had become the first looking-glass nations. On the large wall screen, he watched footage of doses of the cure being distributed in Paris.
Stop right there. Take the 5 seconds preceding that and use it.
Someone behind him approached and handed him a note. We have a situation. Hughes-related. Urgent. Connor excused himself and made his way to his office, where an intelligence agent was waiting with a laptop. Though the government had taken control of the internet, the Sishium's private network, connected by satellite links, was still functional. The agent opened a connection to the Sishium net and pulled up a satellite video feed. It showed three figures opening the iron gate that enclosed Site 79.
Zoom in!
Connor studied their faces. Desmond, Avery, William Moore. So Desmond had found the old man. Together, they could jeopardize everything he had worked for.
How old is this footage?
The agent checked the timestamp. 15 minutes, sir.
You have cameras inside?
The man worked the laptop, brought up the internal views, and rotated through them. On three of the feeds, he saw them moving through the building, searching. They've separated, Connor thought.
Do we have charges in the building?
Yes, standard looking glass precautions, in the labs and file areas. The young man paused. Want us to blow them?
No.
Connor held a hand up.
Let's wait.
They sat in silence for 10 minutes. When William reached the corner office, he stopped at the desk and looked at a picture frame. The night vision camera revealed the change in his expression. Recognition. Realization. Then he rushed to the filing cabinet and began searching through the files.
Whose office is that?
Connor asked. Unknown.
Find out!
Connor snapped. On the screen, William paused at the last drawer, studied a file, and said into his mic,
I've located the target.
Connor stood.
Where's Hughes?
The screen switched to one of the quarantine wards. Hughes was holding a plastic curtain back, disgust on his face.
And the girl?
The view switched to the mechanical room, where Avery was trying to crank a generator.
Blow the charge in the office.
Just the office?
Yes. And show me all the cameras.
The screen switched to a split view of 30 night vision cameras. They were motion activated and could run for up to 30 hours without power. Six cameras went black. Two more showed smoke billowing into the corridors. Another showed the office in flames. Desmond raced through the hallways. Avery, too. Connor leaned back, wondering what the man would do. Desmond stopped at the fire.
He won't go into it,
Connor thought. He was sure of that. Avery gripped Desmond's shoulder, but he threw her off, and to Connor's shock and horror, he ran directly into the fire. Connor stood and exited the office. Sir? He couldn't watch.
I'll be back. Don't leave,
he said. Connor made his way outside, wondering if he had made the right choice. 10 minutes later, he returned to his office, where the agent was still watching the feeds. Three figures stood outside the building. Peyton, William, and Desmond. So, he had made it out, and Peyton was with them. That further complicated things. What do you want to do, sir?
Let's make a new plan. One with no chance of failure.
Chapter 93. Standing in the falling snow, Desmond, Peyton, and William watched the building burn. They were too tired and too injured to walk. Desmond activated his mic.
Avery, do you copy?
No response. Peyton eyed him.
Avery?
The roar of an engine pierced the silence. The vehicle was moving toward them at high speed. Desmond couldn't make it out, but a cloud of dust rose from the road. Headlights came into view, their yellow light fuzzy through the sheets of snow that blew in the wind. They crossed the threshold of the complex, past the iron gate and into the courtyard, tires throwing gravel as they went, barreling directly for them. The vehicle swung around and slid to a stop. The driver door opened. Avery stood and peered across the roof of the black Volga Gaz 21. The engine rattled like an ancient radiator on its last legs.
Figured it wasn't the best night for a walk.
Desmond smiled as the three shivering passengers got in and the old Soviet-era sedan pulled away from the burning building. They decided to take off immediately. If the explosions had been set off deliberately instead of by an automated trigger, an incursion team might be inbound. They flew north initially, then banked east, then south, hoping to confuse anyone trying to track them across multiple satellites. When they were at cruising altitude, William activated the autopilot and limped back to the passenger compartment. Peyton desperately wanted to examine his leg wound, but he waved her off. She had just now recovered from her time in the smoke-filled building. She was still getting sicker, and the physical exertion of the last hour hadn't helped her situation. Her body ached all over. To Avery, William said, "We need to figure out where we're going. You have the folder?" Avery handed it to him, and William threw open the manila cover and began rifling through the pages. "I thought there was more here," he mumbled.
"What is it?"
Peyton asked.
"Requisitions, shipping manifests, medical supplies, water, food, tents, antibiotics, rehydration salts. Everything you'd need to test an outbreak," Desmond said.
"But no shipments of cure or virus? We assumed they were using boxes, packing tape, and water."
"Water is on here," William said, deep in thought. "And the manifests would probably be faked. The actual cure virus would be labeled as something else."
Peyton could tell he thought something was wrong. Desmond took out his sat phone.
"What's the nearest location?"
William looked up as if remembering they were all there.
"Actually, they're all to a single location.
Maybe that location was the distribution node to all the others. Arask 7 is landlocked and pretty out of the way."
"Maybe," William said, sounding unconvinced. "The address is in South Australia, near Adelaide. The destination is an organization called SARA.
South Australia Relief Alliance." He read out the address, which Desmond typed into his phone. Peyton, William, and Avery crowded around him. A tent complex stretched out in a grid next to a single long metal building. It reminded Peyton of the Dadaab refugee camps. A dirt airstrip lay nearby. Desmond panned the map right, then south. Peyton leaned in. What's he looking for? He stopped on a black mark in a brown expanse. She realized then what it was, the remains of his childhood home. The second location the Labyrinth Reality app had provided. It was his second backup, and it lay less than 70 miles from the camp. Why? Was it connected? It had to be. The coincidence was too great.
"The backup Labyrinth location is here," Desmond said. "I wanted myself to go here, and now we know the Sishim was shipping to this site. Even if by some chance those things are unrelated, we can follow two leads at once."
William rifled through the pages in the folder again, scanning the address on each manifest carefully. Peyton said, "What's the matter, Dad?"
"This feels wrong. The location should be a port or a major shipping hub, not a relief organization."
Avery eyed him. "Some of the pages could have been lost during our escape." William glanced away from the group.
"True. Or maybe we got the wrong file," Desmond said.
"Well, we can't exactly go back and search again," Avery said. "But we know they were shipping something to this site."
"At this point, I think going to this site is our only move," Desmond said.
Silence followed. Peyton's eyes met Desmond's. She sensed that he wanted to see what was at his childhood home. She remembered going there with him all those years ago, the pent-up emotions he had pretended weren't there back then. She agreed with him. This was their best option. "I say we check it out," she said, staring at Desmond.
"Me too,"
Avery said. William nodded. He was still distant, lost in thought. Finally, he stood.
"Right. I'll set a course."
Day 13. 5,900,000,000 infected. 9,000,000 dead. Chapter 94. Millen had been asleep for 2 hours when the announcement came over the loudspeaker.
"EOC shift personnel, report to Auditorium A."
The tone was urgent. Millen's bedroom was a small office in the interior of the building. It was dark and cold, but it was quiet. He turned on the table lamp, rolled out of the cot, and staggered to the desk where his pants lay. He pulled them on and rushed downstairs. The auditorium was filled to capacity. Phil stood at center stage, working a laptop.
"All right, listen up. The White House has received another message from the Sishim, a video. I'm going to play it now, then we're going to discuss what we're going to do about it. Please keep quiet."
On the screen behind Stevens, the video played. Sick people stood in the streets of a city, in a line that stretched for blocks. Many coughed as the video panned past them. Some were in wheelchairs. Toward the front of the line, people had rolled their sleeves up. A man in a white coat with a Red Cross logo held a jet injector. He pressed it to each person's shoulder, pulled the trigger, then changed out the single-use protector cap that covered the injector nozzle. A woman seated at a table spoke to each person who'd been injected, typed something on a laptop, presumably the person's name, then handed them a sticker. The camera zoomed in on one of the stickers. X1 Guéri. The subtitle read, X1 Cured. The camera panned around, showed the Eiffel Tower in the distance. The scene changed. It was another city, with a similar line of people, their shirt sleeves rolled up as well. On a hill above them, crumbling stone ruins towered. The Acropolis. Millen recognized the Parthenon instantly. Athens. A man's voice began to speak over the images. He had a slight British accent.
Earlier today, the people of France and Greece received the life-saving cure for the X1 Mandera virus. We offered you the same cure. You declined. You sentenced your citizens to death so that you could stay in power. We are providing this video to give you one last chance. Do the right thing for your people. Save their lives. We ask very little. We seek a peaceful world, where no human can kill another, where science is the engine that turns the world, not greed, not war, not hate or selfishness. In the event that you require further proof, we have covertly deployed the cure inside your borders for you to confirm.
The video changed. On screen was a white woman in her mid-40s. A teenage girl and a younger boy sat with her, a black background behind them. The woman faced the camera and spoke with a southern drawl.
My name is Amy Travis. I live in Johnson City with my daughter Brittany and son Jackson. I was sick. So were my children. A man came to my house, said he was part of a group of researchers called the Sishium. They were testing a potential cure. I agreed to try it. I'm making this video because I want others to know that it works. I'm proof. So are my children.
The video changed again. This time a young black man spoke. A woman sat beside him, and in her lap was a boy only a few years old.
My name is Roger Finney. This is my wife Pamela, and our son Brandon.
A voice off-screen said something Millen couldn't make out.
Oh, yeah. We live in upstate New York, just outside Rome. We were given the cure. We signed the forms. Didn't have much to lose. It worked for us. Felt better that night. Headaches and fever were gone. Cough cleared up soon after that.
The screen faded to black, then began showing still photos from across America. Scenes of the cordon zones, barbed wire across city streets, buses loading and unloading people at the Astrodome in Houston and AT&T Park in San Francisco, canvas-backed trucks unloading supplies, National Guard troop carriers rolling through cities.
This is your country right now, but it doesn't have to be.
More still photos appeared, but now of Paris and Athens, of lines of people receiving the cure, celebrating. Photos of the two American families followed.
Accept our request. Pass the laws that welcome the Looking Glass Commission. If you do not do so within the next 2 hours, we will take our plea directly to your people. They will overthrow your government. The result will be the same, but there will be more bloodshed. Think carefully. Make the right decision, the responsible decision, just as France and Greece have.
The video ended in a black screen. The auditorium erupted in questions. Synchronized shouts swept through the crowd like a beach ball being tossed around at a ball game. On stage, Phil whistled loudly.
Enough! Is it true?
A voice in the back yelled.
Shut up and listen, Stevens shouted. Yes, what you saw is true.
The response was shock and whispers. A part of Millen thought maybe the video was faked. Stevens continued.
5 hours ago, the French and Greek governments agreed to the Sishium's terms. The Sishium, as the terrorists have styled themselves, have taken control of both countries' military assets, power grids, and internet infrastructure. They've also distributed a cure that appears to be viable.
Murmurs went through the auditorium.
The French and Greek governments have provided us with samples of the cure. Military jets flew those samples here 2 hours ago. As we speak, researchers are studying it in this building.
Millen wondered if they were comparing it with the antibodies from Halima and the other villager, as well as the samples he'd brought back from Aelim and Damiria.
As you know, we've been preparing for the prospect of an armed conflict. Right now, survivors and likely survivors are staging here in Atlanta and other cordons. Here in this room, each of you needs to decide which side you're on. If you're going to help us secure this city, or if you want to join the Sishim and attempt to overthrow the government.
For the first time, Millen noticed the Marines at the front and rear exits.
Think hard. Your decision may cost you your life.
Chapter 95. On board the Red Cross plane, Desmond, William, Peyton, and Avery were debating where to land. At Aralsk 7, they'd had no choice. The airstrip was the only access to the island, and it was far enough away from the town and labs to be reasonably safe. But the single dirt runway in Australia was directly adjacent to the camp. Their other options weren't much more appealing, in Peyton's opinion. Desmond wanted to land in a field, but was concerned that the strut supporting the landing gear might buckle, stranding them. Avery advocated landing on a road. They had consulted the map and identified several candidate sites, but William was wary. What if there were power lines, abandoned cars, mailboxes, and other items not on the satellite imagery? Still, it seemed like the best option. They consulted the plane's manual, discovered the width of the wheel track, and did the math. The wheels would fit on the roadway, just barely. They picked a location, did a flyover, and were satisfied the path was clear of obstacles. Peyton buckled herself in and braced for the worst as her father lined up the plane and began descending. The wheels screeched on the pavement, and the entire plane vibrated as it slowed on the straight stretch of blacktop, the morning sun blazing through the windows. The back wheels veered into the dirt shoulder, but William quickly brought the plane back and slowed to a stop. Avery and Desmond left to scout the camp and report back. From the plane's doorway, Peyton watched them hike across the brown terrain, their body armor on, semi-automatic rifles slung across their shoulders. She didn't like leaving Desmond alone with Avery. She still didn't trust the woman. As if sensing Peyton watching him, Desmond stopped and turned. A small smile crossed his lips when he saw her in the doorway. "Mic check," he said.
"Copy," she replied. "Be careful."
"Roger that."
Peyton reminded them again to keep their distance from anyone who might not be infected. When Desmond and Avery disappeared over the next hill, Peyton turned to her father. She had bandaged his leg as best she could and had inspected the other bruises and scrapes on his body, but he needed an X-ray and a pain medication stronger than the ibuprofen she had given him. Those things would have to wait.
"I don't trust her," she said.
He was studying the folder from Aralsk 7, shuffling through the pages like he was counting a deck of playing cards.
"Neither do I."
200 yards from the camp, Desmond and Avery lay flat on their stomachs, taking turns using the binoculars. What Desmond saw didn't make sense. Healthy individuals, moving about. Kids going to school. Breakfast cooking on an open pit grill just outside a building with a concrete floor. Metal poles at each corner. And a corrugated metal roof. People sat at rows of tables eating. About half of them were Aboriginals. There was not a single sick person here. No personnel in PPE. Was this the Sishim's test site? Were these people the lucky ones? The test group who had gotten the viable cure? Desmond focused the binoculars on the largest building, which was also metal, but was enclosed on all sides and had a small loading dock on the back. A sign above a roll-up door read, "Sarah." Below it were two lines of text. "South Australia Relief Alliance," and "A hand up, not a hand out." The door was halfway up, and as Desmond watched, a woman with gray-streaked brown hair ducked under it and walked out onto the concrete loading dock. Spring was turning to summer here, and she was wearing a long-sleeved t-shirt that rippled in the early December wind. Desmond focused the binoculars. His eyes went wide when he saw her face. She had aged some, but there was no mistaking who she was. He racked his brain, trying to reason why and how she could be here. Why the folder at the Sishim lab would have led here. He let the binoculars fall to the ground, Avery sensed his unease.
What?
She took the binoculars, scanned the camp, searching for what had alarmed him.
What did you see, Des?
He stood up. She shifted to her side and stared up at him, aghast.
Get down!
Come on. We're going to the camp.
Are you crazy? You're just gonna walk in there?
Yeah. This place isn't what we think it is. Chapter 96. Desmond hiked across the field with Avery close behind him, making a beeline for the building to the right of the white tents. Avery grabbed his arm.
Will you tell me what's going on?
Not sure myself.
What does that mean?
It means there's something going on here that I don't understand. A piece is missing. He stared straight at the loading dock where the woman stood. She had seen them, had raised a hand to shade her eyes. She was calling to someone inside. Back at the plane, William winced as Peyton taped the ankle again.
Sorry, she whispered.
It's okay. Just hurts a bit.
He held up a page and studied the handwriting in the margin. He was sure of it now. He picked up the handheld radio.
Bravo, Tango. Report.
He released the button, but no response came. As Desmond and Avery approached, the woman stepped down from the loading dock and walked across the gravel drive. She stopped where the field began, squinting, trying to see who they were. Desmond wondered if she would recognize him. The man walked out of the building, came to her side, asked her something. She shook her head. Avery unslung her rifle.
Don't do that, Desmond said.
This is creeping me out, Des. Tell me what's going on.
I told you I don't know.
The people eating at the tables under the open-air building had noticed them. Some stood, trying to get a glimpse of the two armor-clad figures approaching. When they were 30 yards away, the man waded into the field. Desmond guessed he was in his late 30s. His long brown locks, blowing in the wind, reminded Desmond of a surfer. When he spoke, his accent was Australian, his tone suspicious.
Can I help you?
Avery cut her eyes to Desmond.
No, I don't think so, but I think she can.
He kept marching forward past the man, who hurried back to the woman. She stood still, showing no hint of nervousness or fear, only curiosity. When he was 10 yards from her, Desmond stopped and studied her face.
Hello, Charlotte.
William tried the radio again, and again there was no response. Peyton could tell he was getting more nervous by the second.
What is it?
She asked.
I'm not sure.
He began assembling his body armor, getting ready.
Are you going out there?
Yes.
They both heard it at the same time, a truck engine, barreling over the hills. Peyton stood, was about to move to the door, but her father caught her arm.
This is important, Peyton. If you recognize anyone at the camp, don't say anything. Tell me first.
She nodded.
Okay.
She walked to the back of the plane to cough. The fever and chills were getting worse. She pulled her shirt up. The rash had advanced. On the top of her hand, where she had coughed, were tiny specks of blood. She wiped them on the underside of her shirt. She didn't want her father, or Desmond, to know how sick she was. A few minutes later, Desmond appeared at the plane's door.
It's safe. What did you find?
William asked.
It's not what we thought. Come see for yourself.
Chapter 97. They rode in an old Land Rover, Avery behind the wheel, Desmond beside her, facing the back seat, explaining what they'd found to Peyton and her father.
It's a relief camp. They take in anyone displaced by natural disasters. Hurricanes, floods, drought, earthquakes. They take some folks who've just fallen on hard times, too. Their focus is getting people back on their feet.
Do you think they tested the cure here?
Peyton asked.
I doubt it. You'll see. Do you know anyone there?
William asked. Desmond cocked his head, surprised by the question.
I do. The woman running it. Charlotte. In 1983, my family passed away during the Ash Wednesday bushfires. Charlotte was one of the relief workers who helped in the aftermath. She took care of me, helped find my uncle and get me to America.
Have you spoken with her since then? William asked. Desmond thought for a moment. Not that I know of.
But it's possible. Did she recognize you?
Yes, she did. William stared out the window, the wheels turning in his head.
Interesting.
The camp wasn't high-tech. It was optimized to stretch every dollar to feed as many mouths and shelter as many lives as possible. The only advanced piece of medical equipment was an old X-ray machine, donated by the Royal Adelaide Hospital. Peyton insisted on using it on her father's leg. He protested as he limped to the corrugated iron building, wincing every time his foot hit the ground.
This really isn't necessary, Peyton.
It really is, Dad. Desmond and Avery found Charlotte in her office, tapping at her cell phone. They kept their distance and made no physical contact. Peyton had expressed serious reservations about entering the camp at all. She still didn't know how the virus was transmitted from person to person. But Desmond and William had argued that their need for information was more important than quarantine. They had to take some risks. Ultimately, Peyton conceded, on the condition that the four of them remain in the building and avoid interacting with any camp residents other than Charlotte and her second-in-command. Charlotte motioned them in, and Desmond and Avery sat across from her, in a pair of 70s-style wood and cloth chairs that had probably been salvaged from an old government building.
Any luck? He asked.
No. Internet still routes to the Aussie Cordon website. I check twice a day to be sure.
She set the device aside.
Did you find your friends?
Desmond nodded, told her about the X-ray.
I'm glad we could help. It's about all we have around here. Broken bones are by far the most common injury we see.
She paused.
And some burns.
Desmond nodded. Seeing her and hearing her words brought back a flurry of memories. He could vividly remember lying in that elementary school, in the makeshift cubicle, her reading to him by lantern light. She had been a lighthouse in the darkness. He wondered what she was now, how she was involved.
Did you get my letters?
She asked. He raised his eyebrows. A remorseful smile crossed Charlotte's face, one that said a fear she had long held had just been confirmed.
After you left, I sent them every week, for maybe a year, less frequently after that, every month.
Desmond imagined Orville staggering out to the mailbox, half drunk, tossing them in the trash and telling the mailman not to deliver anything with Desmond's name on it.
Boy, don't need no bleeding heart woman making him any softer than he already is,
he would have said. To Charlotte, Desmond replied, My uncle was a complicated man. He wasn't much for keeping in touch with folks, or allowing me to.
I suspected you never got them. I thought about you a lot after you left. Wondered how things turned out. Even thought about coming to America to visit.
I wish you had.
Was it terrible?
No, not at all, Desmond lied. Charlotte seemed to see through it. She grew quiet, stared down at her desk.
What about you?
He asked.
Not much to tell.
I doubt that.
She shook her head. The Alliance is my life. This work, these people.
You're good at it. You changed my life.
That made her smile.
Did you ever get married?
No, she said quietly. I came close once.
That guy who was at the school?
Charlotte thought a moment.
Oh, him.
No, that was not a close call. Avery was getting impatient.
I think we should talk about the reason we're here.
Desmond exhaled.
Right. Charlotte, we found this place because of supplies shipped here. We want to ask you about that, but first, I think I should give you some background.
Peyton studied the X-ray of her father's ankle, which showed no fractures.
It's just a sprain, she said to him.
I'm telling you I'm perfectly fine.
Just try to stay off of it and it'll heal up in a few weeks.
The world doesn't have a few weeks.
He made to stand up, but she blocked his path and put her hands on her hips. He exhaled and sank back down. Despite his continued protests, she used some of the supplies in the medical closet to make a proper splint. When she was done, they walked down the corridor toward Charlotte's office. Desmond's voice drifted out into the hall. He was describing what they'd found in Kazakhstan at Arosk 7. Peyton pushed the door open. The woman sitting behind the desk looked to be in her early 50s, with a slightly lined face and trim physique. Peyton did a double take.
She turned quickly, trying to hide her shock. Sorry, I forgot something. Be right back. She grabbed her father's arm, guided him back down the hall to the medical exam room and shut the door.
Peyton, I really am fine.
I know her.
What?
That woman. I recognize her. I can't believe it.
Chapter 98. When Peyton and her father returned to Charlotte's office, Desmond was laying the folder on her desk.
These are the shipping manifests we found in Kazakhstan.
Charlotte scanned the pages.
They look accurate.
There was no sender name, just the shipping company.
Charlotte was still reading through the pages.
They were paid for by the Zeno Foundation.
The name caught Peyton's interest. According to Avery's story, Zeno was the Greek philosopher who had founded the Sicium over 2,000 years ago.
What do you know about the foundation? Desmond asked.
Not much. They're very generous. They had a website where I could request supplies, food, water, even money.
Who was your contact there?
Tanner Goodwin.
The name meant nothing to Peyton.
Did they ever ask you to do anything? To conduct trials on experimental vaccines or medicines?
Charlotte looked disturbed by the idea.
No, and I would have refused,
no matter how badly we needed the help.
The four of them questioned Charlotte at length, exploring a number of possible ways she might be tied to the outbreak, but found no common thread. As best they could tell, the Sicium seemed to genuinely want to support her work.
It's possible that I sent the supplies, Desmond said, though I don't know why I would have done it in secret.
A good point, William said.
Charlotte, I wonder if you'd excuse us for a moment.
Of course, I'll just wait outside.
When she closed the door behind her, William said,
We're getting nowhere here, and we're running out of time.
There's still the location near here, Desmond said. My childhood home? The second backup from the Labyrinth Reality app?
I think it's our next move.
William nodded to Avery.
The two of you should check it out. We'll continue questioning Charlotte.
10 minutes later, Peyton, William, and Charlotte stood on the loading dock watching the Land Rover drive down the dusty dirt road that led out of the camp.
Charlotte, could we trouble you with a few more questions?
William asked.
Of course.
She held her arm out, motioning them back into her office. William closed the door after they entered.
Perhaps learning more about you might help us understand how you're connected.
She raised her eyebrows.
Oh, all right then.
Desmond told us you were a relief worker in the early 80s.
I was, well, I was at university then, but I volunteered as much as I could.
And after uni?
Med school.
Specialty?
Family medicine. I got a master's in public health. That was really my passion.
Where did you work?
After school? The WHO.
Some of the cheeriness faded from her, as if it was something she didn't want to talk about.
And you lost someone close to you there?
Her eyes grew wide.
Yes, in 1991. That was the year Peyton had seen her. She'd been 13 years old then, standing at a gravesite in San Francisco. The cemetery was on a hill outside of town. Skyscrapers in the bay stretched out in the distance. A thick cloud of fog hung over the water and snaked into the city, its white tendrils flowing in and out of the red steel supports of the Golden Gate Bridge and the glittering silver buildings. When the service ended, a woman in her early 30s had walked over, a sad smile on her lips. She spoke to Peyton's mother, then her sister Madison, and finally to Peyton. Her accent was Australian, her voice kind. Your brother meant a great deal to me, Peyton. He told me you wanted to be a physician. Not anymore.
The woman took a small metal item from her coat pocket and held it out to Peyton.
He's very proud of you. I believe he would have wanted you to have this.
She placed the small silver pin in Peyton's hand. The teenager examined it.
I thought it burned. I had it cleaned and refinished.
The woman smiled.
I wanted you to have it in the same condition it was in when your brother carried it. All things can be repaired, Peyton. Some simply require more time than others. Don't let tragedy take your dreams away.
The woman in the shabby office in Australia looked at Peyton now, 25 years later, with the same kindness in her eyes. And now, recognition.
You're Andrew's younger sister, aren't you?
Peyton nodded.
I still think about your brother a great deal. Miss him a great deal.
Me too,
Peyton said quietly. Would you like to see him again?
Chapter 99. Desmond walked slowly to the burned remains of the home where he'd spent the first 5 years of his life. Weeds had reclaimed some of the once charred terrain. Only the masonry foundation and fireplace now stood, like a blackened tombstone. He felt his cell phone buzz in his pocket. He pulled it out. There was a message from the Labyrinth Reality app. Download complete.
Download of what? Another memory?
Without warning, Desmond's vision blurred. His head swam. He staggered, lost his balance, and fell to a knee.
What's happening to me?
He braced himself on the ground with one hand. He felt nauseous. He tried to focus, but the memory came like a blow to the head, hitting hard, overwhelming him. He stood in a bathroom at a long vanity with two sinks. In the mirror, he saw a bank of three urinals, all empty. He seemed to be alone. He couldn't place the location, but he felt like this wasn't long ago, probably shortly before he woke up in Berlin. He stared into his own eyes in the mirror and spoke solemnly.
I hope you know what's going on by now. This location is a backup. I wasn't able to figure out where the Sishium was manufacturing the cure, but I know they shipped it all around the world. There must be a storage site close by, maybe in Adelaide. Search for it. I'm also enclosing the rest of the memory that took place here. It may help you, but it could also hurt. It's leverage, but it goes both ways.
The bathroom disappeared, and Desmond was back in Australia, on that day in 1983 when the bushfires killed his family. Except this memory was from that morning, before the fire killed his mother. He didn't understand what he was seeing. His arms felt weak. Then he felt Avery at his side. He closed his eyes, thought he would throw up. When he opened them again, he saw figures clad in woodland camouflage racing in from the tree line, a dozen of them. He reached back for his rifle, but it was gone. It lay on the ground 20 yards away. Who had thrown it over there? He pushed up, but a boot hit his chest.
Stay down, Des.
Avery towered over him. A rifle was pointed in his face.
Avery, I don't want to hurt you.
She studied him.
You remember, don't you?
Yes.
Chapter 100. Peyton watched Charlotte rummage through the old filing cabinets in the storage room.
It's here somewhere, along with some other things of his I've kept.
Peyton's father cut his eyes at her, silently saying, Where's this going? Charlotte pulled an old VHS tape from the bottom drawer. In a room with a small cathode ray tube TV, she popped the tape in a VCR and pressed play.
This was taken the day Andrew died.
Charlotte studied the picture, which was coming into focus.
He's in Uganda, on his way to Kapchorwa, his last stop.
Peyton saw her brother riding in the back of an SUV, which bounced on a dirt road with a trail of dust rising behind it.
It was so incredibly good to see his face again.
His hair was dark like Peyton's, but his features were less Asian than hers. He looked more British, like her father and her mother's father.
Kapchorwa is a small town in East Uganda, Charlotte said. Roughly 24 miles from the border with Kenya. Only a few thousand people lived in the town then, but many more from the surrounding villages visited each month for the open-air market and hospital. This was 1991, she continued. We were just realizing how bad HIV/AIDS was then. The virus had gone undetected for decades. It was spreading quickly in the late 80s and early 90s. Millions around the world were infected, most with no idea. They lived for years, often decades, without symptoms, spreading it unknowingly to their spouses and others. The virus was deadly for 99% of those who contracted it. The only available treatment merely slowed the virus's spread within the body. It was very brave what Andrew was doing, visiting these towns and villages, standing in a room, telling these people assembled that their neighbors were dying of a deadly disease and that they might also be infected. But we had to do it. It was the only hope of stopping the pandemic. You were part of the effort too?
Peyton asked. Charlotte nodded.
I was in Kampala, waiting for him to return.
The video switched to a scene inside a ramshackle building. Ugandans sat on worn wooden benches, painted white walls peeling behind them. Two ceiling fans buzzed overhead,
and the audience fanned themselves as they waited. It reminded Peyton of a rural church in America's deep south, Alabama or Mississippi, perhaps. The analogy was apt. The assembled were disciples of a sort. These were community leaders, doctors, nurses, police officers, teachers, family planning association workers, resistance committee members, and village elders gathered to hear a message that could determine whether the people who depended on them lived or died. The Ugandan Ministry of Health had told the crowd only that they were to receive a critical announcement regarding public health and safety. Like other places Andrew had visited, the residents of Kapchorwa district had turned out en masse. Over 100 people filled the room. Those arriving late, after the benches had filled, stood at the back. Andrew waited at the front, where the collapsible lectern he carried around the country had been set up. It was his pulpit. To the credit of those assembled, not many had stared at him when they came in. Their eyes had lingered only a second or two on the tall white man, and many had averted their eyes when they saw his prosthetic left arm. The congregation grew quiet when the district administrator cleared his throat and stepped up to the mic. His name was Akya, and he spoke in heavily accented English.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he said,
then paused to make eye contact with as many of the assembled as he could.
"Thank you for being here today. What you're about to hear may shock you. It may change the way you see every person around you. It will likely frighten you. I personally am frightened. But I want you to know that the government of Uganda is committed to fighting this deadly epidemic. We will win, and you will be part of this great victory, which will be remembered by your children and their children. With that, I welcome our guest, Andrew Shaw of the World Health Organization."
A few claps followed, but not many. Perhaps that was because so many held fans, or because they weren't sure whether they should clap after such a frightening introduction. Andrew stepped forward and began the presentation he had given a dozen times before. He spoke with a British accent he had acquired growing up in London. In the early 80s, the CDC, the principal disease detection agency in the United States, began tracking a very deadly, very strange disorder. It attacks the immune system. When people contract this disease, they become unable to survive common infections. This immune deficiency develops over time, but it is lethal. A person who could normally fight off a cold or diarrhea or malaria might die from it. We call this condition acquired immune deficiency syndrome, or AIDS. It's the result of a virus called HIV. We've developed a test for this virus. We've tested blood at hospitals in Uganda, as well as samples from the general population. Based on these tests, the Ugandan Ministry of Health estimates that roughly 14% of the people in this country are infected with HIV. That equates to 1 in every 7 people, or about 15 of the people in this room. The people looked around, shifting uncomfortably. Spaces were made between people in the pews. A few people held their breath, and questions erupted.
"Is there a cure? A treatment? A vaccine?"
Akia, the district administrator, held up his hands, and the room again fell silent. "There's currently no vaccine or cure," Andrew said. "But there is a treatment that prolongs the life of those infected. It's called AZT, and it will soon be available in Uganda and throughout Africa. In addition, the smartest researchers in the world are working on other similar drugs, vaccines, and even a cure as we speak. I hope they'll be available soon as well. But for now, there's only one certain cure for a disease with no treatment or vaccine. Isolation. We must isolate the virus so that it can't spread. If it has no place to replicate, the virus will die out. We have that power. The people in this room can stop the virus in this district. The solution is education and lifestyle changes. That's what I'm offering you today, and that's what we want you to teach to the people you serve." Akia began passing out the information packets as Andrew continued. "First, you should know that this disease cannot be spread by sitting or standing next to someone." The rows of worried attendees relaxed. "HIV is not an airborne infection. You also can't get it from shaking hands, or hugging or touching someone. It's transmitted in 4 principal ways: birth, blood exchange, needle use, and unprotected sex. Blood and semen. There's nothing we can do about birth. A pregnant woman who's infected will pass the infection on to a newborn. But the other methods of transmission are all preventable. To combat the spread of HIV via blood exchange, the WHO and the Ugandan Ministry of Health
are implementing testing procedures at hospitals and clinics throughout the country to detect the virus. That leaves needle use and unprotected sex. Sex is by far the most prevalent method of transmission and the biggest concern. Those who are more sexually active are at far greater risk of contracting HIV. We believe, for example, that 86% of the sex workers in the country are HIV positive. Several of the men in the room grew still, their eyes wide. About 1 in every 3 lorry drivers has the disease. IV drug users are also at high risk. However, as I said, there is a solution. Uganda has developed a simple method for stopping the spread. We call it A, B, C, D.
A for abstinence.
B for be faithful. C for use a condom. And D for die. If you're not married, choose abstinence. If you're married, be faithful. If you can't be faithful, use a condom. And if you don't use a condom, you die. There's one other thing I want you to take away from this meeting. Compassion. The people with this virus deserve love and understanding and care, not discrimination. They don't mean you harm. They're just like any of us. Please don't stigmatize people with HIV. As I've said, many will be children or simply born with the disease. We don't choose how we were born. That last line drew every eye to his missing left arm. In the first town where he had said it, he had realized why he had been selected for this assignment. The session lasted almost 2 hours. When it was over, the group filed out of the whitewashed room with their pamphlets in hand and promises to contact Akia and others in the district office with any questions. The 2 Ugandan soldiers assigned to escort and guard Andrew began breaking down the lectern. He gathered his papers and stashed them in his bag. Akia reviewed the roster of attendees.
"We did pretty well. Only 2 didn't attend.
Do you know them?"
"Yes, they are from the same village, Kashesha."
"Where is it?" Andrew asked.
"In Mount Elgon National Park, near the Kenyan border, about 20 kilometers from here. I will go. It is important to me that everyone in my district knows of this disease."
Andrew slung his bag over his shoulder. "I'll go with you."
"No, it may be dangerous."
"I'm coming with you, Akia. If it's important to you, it's important to me. We're in this together." The man smiled broadly.
"Well then, let us go while we still have the light."
The tape went black and the VCR clicked. Charlotte stared at the old TV for a moment. "The Kimra crew went back to our regional command post at Mbale. That was the last anyone saw of Andrew. We found his burned remains along with Akia and 100 villagers deep in Mount Elgon National Park. It was very brave what he was doing. HIV/AIDS is almost common knowledge now, but it was new and very scary back then. Uganda was a huge success in the fight against the AIDS epidemic. It was the first country where the WHO pioneered a single national plan and budget that all donors agreed to use in